Today on the Inside Flap.
Clara Barton has fudged her passes and she's heading out and she wants to be part of the action. She really wanted to be a soldier, but she couldn't be.
Right.
She's this carriage with four horses loaded supplies, and she's out and she ends up right on the edge of the cornfield. And then when the darkness falls, they say, oh, we can't operate anymore in the darkness. She says, oh no, I brought lanterns. So and so come this a few nights later, and the Lincolns are going to the theater, to Ford's theater, and they invite the Grants to sit in their box with them. And Julius says, no way. I'm not doing that.
Oh, wow.
And Ulysses, who's had his own experience, says, okay, me neither. Let's think up an excuse why we don't have to go.
And there's some adult, like a 30-year-old adult in there.
Playing dodgeball?
Aggressively playing dodgeball. That's and so taking weird. Pride. Taking pride in, you know, young, you know, 11 and 12-year-old kids sitting there, you know, beating the crap out of him with the dodgeball.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. My name is Dave Medicus. Thank you so much for joining us. Seated across the table to my right, seated today, is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
And across the table to my left, furiously messing with all the controls of the mixer, is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. How are those headphone levels working out for you?
They're pretty good now.
They're good?
They got so loud, and I tried all of the knobs before I got to my own. Do you need me to turn yours down?
Now, see, you were messing with my, you muted me, you muted Andrew. Now I can't hear anything.
Okay.
Now, there
okay.
we go.
All right.
Thank you so much for joining us. We have a big show planned for you today. This is episode number 47. Coming up on the show tonight, or today, depending on when you're listening to us, this morning, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize nominated author S.C. Gwynn. Sam, it was great to talk to him all about his new fascinating book, Hymns of the Republic, the story of the final year of the American Civil War. This was a really good book. We'll talk about it later.
Sounds great.
Really, really love this book. This guy's really interesting. He's got some entertaining stories to tell.
I like stuff about the Civil War.
Yeah, who doesn't? We'll get to that in just a few. Also on the show, we have three book recommendations, a YA shout out, and of course, the ever popular audio book of the week. So go ahead and set your timer for that one. And we have one last chance, since this is the last week before Halloween, one last chance to talk a little horror, and we'll do that for you in a little bit. But first, some quick stories from the week for you guys. We had
And snow is falling.
Is falling as we record this.
And so I drove over in the snow.
Yeah.
And it's about a 10-15 minute drive from the house, but it's the kind of snow that really wants to kind of lull you into
trance-like
into something. And so it really was tough to concentrate.
Why is that?
On the road. And I don't know.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
It sounds like a horror book right there. It sounds like it's beginning to a horror story.
They say that you can self-hypnotize yourself. Like, we all do it. Like, when we drive, sometimes we are self-hypnotizing. If you, like, wake up and you're like, I don't even know where I was, even though you've been driving
right.
and you're awake. But that kind of snow is a real quick self-hypnosis.
Yeah, it's softly falling. It's gentle.
It's even.
It's mesmerizing.
It comes at you like the stars in the Star Wars.
That's right.
Now, I know that there's a book. And I think the book is about an author that's driving in the snow and has a car accident.
I'm trying to think if I can think of one.
But how does he describe... You don't know which book I'm talking about?
Of course I know.
Oh, okay.
Misery.
Misery.
Stephen King.
Oh,
Laura didn't.
But does he describe the snow in that book?
Well, that was a blinding snowstorm, I believe. And it was an icy road, or maybe it was just the roads that were bad. I know he just finished the book, so he was coming down off the mountain from his cabin. Yeah. I don't think that was a gentle hypnotic snow. More like a a wintry bluster.
I do wonder if that's a thing, if like an EMS, like tech, if they would know, like, oh yeah, it's this type of snow. Oh, watch out, we're going to get snow days.
We got another one. accident by hypnosis. We got another one coming in. Snow hypnosis. Snowposis.
There you go. I like snowposis.
Yeah, so maybe we'll have a little delay tomorrow for school. Not likely, as we haven't had one in all my years teaching here, never. But speaking of teaching, we had parent-teacher conferences the other day. Now, this is different. I was telling you guys a little bit about back-to-school night. This is different. This is where we get to sit in our rooms from 10 o'clock in the morning until 6 in the evening.
That sounds like such a blast.
Uh-huh. On a Friday.
Wait, Dave, your windowless room.
My windowless room, sitting there and just wait for the droves of parents to show up. I believe I could count on less than 10 fingers how many parents I did have, unfortunately. But I did think I'd share just some of the things I like to tell my students' parents. I have a couple of go-tos that I've collected over the years. Because, you know, these parents, they come and they hear the same thing from the teachers. So I like to mix it up a little bit. So if a parent comes to me and says...
Andrew just shook his head.
The parent comes to me and says, my student just loves your class. I have a stock reply I respond with. And now the key to this is to do so with a straight face and say it with complete sincerity. So, Andrew, I would like for you to play the part of the parent and you tell me how much your child loves my class.
My son, Jeffrey, just loves your class, Mr. Medicus.
Yeah, well, that's because I'm a great teacher. That usually elicits a little kind of a strange look from the parent at first. You can see like an instant shock and then just, okay.
That's awkward. Right. Please tell me you don't do that.
I do it. Of course I do it. Oh. I also like to tell an unsuspecting parent, you know, I really enjoy having your class. I love when he shows up on time. Just a really great student to joke around with, or contributes a lot in class. Just one small problem is they curse too much in class and they like to cuss me out. And the great thing is, and you find the nicest kid possible to say it to their parent.
That's really funny.
And then they give you the first. It's like a look of shock, and then it quickly turns to a look of anger as their head whips over to their kid, and it's like, how dare you act one way in the house and you come to school and act like this? And then the kid's eyes get really wide and he gives me a look like, what? I don't know. And then he realizes that it's me he's talking to, or she, and they know that I'm just joking. And then they turn to the parent, no, he's joking. And I keep it up for an additional 5 to 10 seconds. I'm like, no, I wish I could tell you I was joking, but we just need to do something about the mouth on him.
Oh, wow.
And then I do break out this one only if I know that the parent, I can tell they have a good vibe about them. I'll tell them, I do enjoy having your kid in class. The one thing is, the other day he did reach out and smacked me in the face. So I don't know if there's something. Is that something that...
I hope you're careful, because some parents, I guess parents who show up
listen,
aren't like
parents
to
who
be
show up to
parent
teacher conferences. Okay. Can understand a little shtick.
Yeah. And you know what? They're not elementary. I
call it parent shtick conferences is what I like to call it. So there's a lot of shtick that goes on when they walk into my room. And, I was thinking, because I had a lot of time as I was sitting in my classroom for 10 hours thinking about, or I guess 8 hours, thinking about how kids have it a little bit better. Andrew, you and I went to high school together. I think they've got a little bit better now. And I've got 3 reasons why. Number one. School breakfast. Did you eat school breakfast at, did you eat breakfast in high school at school?
Never ate breakfast.
No. Okay.
I don't even know if they offered it when I was in school.
Well, they've got it now, and it's come a long way, because now what they're serving, and my kids come in first thing in the morning, they grab their food, and they come into my room, and they're chowing down on pizza. Mm. So they get pizza for breakfast.
Really?
Yes, pizza.
That sounds ideal for a teenager.
Mm-hmm, yeah, who wouldn't want to have some pizza for breakfast?
Now, my wife's a great cook, and But quite often, the kids come home and they tell us how good the school lunch is.
Really?
Yeah. And so, I mean, I don't know. Huh. I know all schools aren't like this, but, the kids are like, oh, man, we had a taco bar today. And
wow.
We had fish sticks, or we had this, we had that. But you know, once a week they come open a home bragging about how good the school lunch is.
Those are the Littleton schools.
Sylvia refuses to get school lunch. I wish I could get her to even get it one day a week.
Yeah.
Because I'm still packing it. In high school, she'll have to pack her own probably, but I'm still a sucker, so.
Well, the kids don't like the lunches at at my school, but they do love chowing down on that pizza for breakfast. Number two, AirPods. So now every student, any kid is growing out their hair long because what they do is they'll wear their hair down over their ears.
That's
and
funny.
Stick an AirPod in their ear.
That could affect a whole hair trend.
And now they have the ability to listen to whatever the hell they want.
Sure.
Without me even knowing what's going on and basically just tune the class out.
There was a girl that did that in my jury duty.
Oh, really?
The judge had to ask her to take her AirPods
off. Oh, he saw it, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of jury duty.
Oh, did you get it?
So, no. So, Katie got the mail, and you think she had won the lottery. Woohoo! Woohoo! But she got a summons for jury duty for the first time in her life.
Oh, and the first time.
First time ever.
Yep, so like the first week in November.
Oh, wow.
She's going to be going for jury duty, but she was very excited.
Okay.
To be
excited. Yeah, yeah. To be called.
I had the opposite reaction that I would have.
Yeah.
So that's number two, AirPods. And the third one might...
We'll see how excited she is after 7 hours.
That's true.
When nothing happens.
When absolutely nothing happens.
Yeah.
The third and final reason why I think kids have it better. Andrew, you might disagree with this. Laura, I think you'll agree. This is why kids have it better now. Because according to my gym teacher, dodgeball is now illegal.
You are not allowed
to play dodgeball. So you will never hear anyone say...
You can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
There is no dodgeball to be had.
Huh.
So I'm fairly certain that my kids in elementary school are playing dodgeball.
Well,
Sylvia's definitely played dodgeball.
They are not in Denver Public School.
Oh, they are in Littleton. It's, it's still,
because apparently it,
can't speak tonight.
According to my gym teacher, he was told it encourages bullying behavior. Because someone could throw a ball at someone.
Because they're hurling balls at people.
That's what you do in dodgeball. So he is not allowed to play dodgeball.
Huh. Honestly, there's a lot of games out there. You don't have to play dodgeball.
Well, yeah, but any game you play,
any game you play does not involve hitting another person with a ball.
Well, basketball, you set a pick on somebody.
It's different.
Baseball, you're whipping a wiffle ball at somebody.
No, you're not. You're not trying to hit another person.
Well, there's reason number three. I think you were all behind that one. No dodgeball.
Yeah, you're trying to hit another person.
No, with foam balls. Not even like the hard rubber balls we had when we were growing up.
Well, we had the rubber balls. I still remember that. Bouncing off of your back as you like turn and flee in terror.
So I think they are introducing modified flag dodgeball. Of course. I'm making that, but I will tell you a story.
I'd be waving that white flag.
So out here in Denver, we've got all these beautiful indoor play places for kids, trampolines. Yeah. I mean, just all kinds of stuff. But they all also seem to have a dodgeball.
I don't think that's unique to Denver.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Cold climates.
So they've got these dodgeball courts
and hot climates.
Really?
And I cannot tell you the number of times I will go there. And there's some adult, like a 30-year-old adult in there.
Playing dodgeball?
Aggressively playing dodgeball.
That's
and
so
taking
weird.
Pride. Taking pride in, you know, young, you know, 11 and 12-year-old kids sitting there and, you know, beating the crap out of them with a dodgeball.
Where have you seen this? This is so weird.
You know, I've seen it in Centennial.
Oh,
well, they watched the movie one too many times.
Well, you know, and it's just like...
You can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
What's that from?
From Dodgeball.
Dodgeball. Oh. Yeah.
Ben Stiller.
Sorry, I don't remember.
Great movie.
I blocked it out.
But no, unfortunately, some people...
How they get out their aggression.
Well,
I guess.
But, you know, a full-grown adult in the third or fourth decade of life sitting there...
That's weird.
No.
That's weird.
That's wrong. And funny, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what's been going on in my life. Laura, how's your week been?
So I had a photo shoot. I'm an interior designer. I feel like I say that every week, but just in case there's a new listener.
We do get new listeners every week.
And we have a grocery store that's near us that has fantastic flowers. Just great. So I was there at a grocery store in the middle of the day. A grocery store I don't always go to.
Is this the one that Jack Ruby is the general manager
of? No, this is not the Jack Ruby grocery store.
It's the other grocery store.
This is what I call suburban heaven grocery store. Yeah. So at Suburban Heaven, and there was a bag boy who's older than me who handed me a cart.
Okay.
And he called me young lady, and he smiled at me. And I got, here's what I'm going to say. And then when I saw him again later,
yes,
he called me young lady again.
Oh,
and smiled. And I want to tell you, there is a certain point in a woman's life.
Yes.
When you've already been called young lady and you were a young lady.
Yes.
And then there's another point in your life when you know, and you know that the other person knows
that you aren't
a young lady anymore.
Uh-huh.
And that it's not entirely accurate. And that does not make me feel good about myself.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. And I know people do it and they mean nice. They mean well. And I'm not putting anyone down who says this.
Mm-hmm.
I have a pet peeve when someone says, oh, is it your 29th birthday again? Because it's like, what age do they start thinking that's funny?
Right.
It's clearly not funny if they think you're 33.
That's
true. If
they
think you're 35, yeah. Is it funny? I don't think so. I think it's over 40 when people start thinking that that's when you want to start turning 29 again. I don't know, though. But that's that like weird, like, it's a compliment, but it's not. We both know that it's not really a compliment.
Or when someone will say, it's a happy 90th birthday, young man. They'll say, you know, they'll say stuff like that.
Does that affect guys, though? I know sometimes you guys get called young man.
Yeah,
by an older woman.
By somebody
who's
older, absolutely.
Does that bother you at all? I'm thinking that it wouldn't bother you, though.
It doesn't bother me whatsoever. No, no.
I would be annoyed if somebody referred to me as young. You know what I mean? And mostly, I'm in a corporate work environment. So somebody's calling me young.
it's a put-down.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a put-down.
Yeah, I guess when my students call me young man, I rip off my shirt and say, I'm a grown-ass man. I don't know who you're talking to.
I find it a little patronizing. But in that same token, I think that very same day, I was eating a sweet tango apple, Dave.
Mm.
And the sweet tango apples are delicious.
Sweet tango.
And I hadn't tried it yet, and I was biting into it, and I was driving by myself. Driving, car full of flowers, just gotten called young lady multiple times at the grocery store by a bag boy who's older than me. And
you're a young lady.
I'm going like 55 on Santa Fe, which is a pretty big highway here, road.
Mm-hmm.
And I choked on the apple, on the sweet tango apple.
Oh, no.
While I was driving.
Oh, no.
And to the point where I had a panicked moment of like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And I got it out, but I also thought, how many times, what are you supposed to do if you're by yourself in a car and you choke on something? And then I thought, maybe I should never
eat an apple while you're driving.
I was eating it too fast because it tasted really good.
Well, you know,
it's kind of embarrassing.
They say you're supposed to give yourself a Heimlich.
I know, but I was driving.
Throw yourself against the steering wheel.
And I'm in the middle lane going 55 to 60 miles an hour. And I'm surrounded by other cars.
You're going
to
crash your car if you try to
throw
yourself.
Have you guys ever choked on anything while you're driving?
I think a fireball. I think I got a fireball. I remember I had a fireball. And if you're not careful, when you pop that sucker in there and you are sucking the hotness out of it, sometimes it's too hot. So you're rolling it around in your mouth, trying to cool it off or sticking your tongue out. And then it kind of rolled. I stuck my tongue out with the fireball in my tongue because I didn't want to give my hand. Because, you know, sometimes you grab it with your hand, but then your hand gets sticky. Right. And you don't like that. You don't want that.
Yeah.
And so I stuck my tongue out. Well, the fireball rolled back down my tongue as if it was a bowling lane. And then kind of like started going down my throat and it momentarily lodged in there.
Oh my gosh.
I was driving and I did the old acting like I was trying to hock up a lunger.
Yeah.
And
it
and
hurt.
It
like
out.
My throat hurt after I hacked up that apple.
I chucked the fireball
and then
out the window.
I was driving and thinking, what would I do in a similar, if this happens again, is all I could think of.
You slam on your brakes and start running up and down Santa Fe Boulevard, waving your arms in the air, and whereupon you'll quickly get run over.
Yeah.
And you won't have to worry about choking to death, which is kind of ignominious, I think. It's better to get run over than it is to choke to death on an apple driving down Santa Fe.
With a car full of flowers.
Well, they would save on funeral arrangements. True.
So yes. My choking story happened in a sushi restaurant.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I was eating a piece of sushi, and it basically had the seaweed wrapper kind of on the outside.
Yep.
And as I was eating it, I guess the seafood wrapper unrolled.
Oh.
down my throat.
Oh, it
and
came
so, and
undone.
So I had,
yeah.
so I had
oh
the seaweed.
Gosh.
I had the seaweed like halfway down my throat.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there trying to like get a hold of this like slippery seaweed.
You're trying to pull it out like a magician pulling out this.
Trying to get it out of there. But it was, you know, it was a panicked. It was a panic few seconds.
It's panicky.
Yeah.
Even that's when you take the wasabi and shove it down your throat, and that'll.
Did anyone know that you were in distress?
Ejected out of there.
So,
were you at like a client meeting or something?
So, you know, Katie could basically see that there was an issue, but
Katie looked the other way.
But you know, it had started and it was over.
Nothing.
Before somebody, I mean, you know,
it was over
cause,
before
because it all happens in 5 or 10
seconds.
I know
mm-hmm. It does. It happens quick, but that's when time slows down.
That is when time slows down. Absolutely.
Speaking of time slowing down.
Yes, Andrew.
I was watching a show on TV.
Uh-huh.
And so
interesting.
And this
look
was
this guy.
And
this
was
TV.
And there's a professor who basically did an experiment with a guy. And he did an experiment. He showed him 10 pictures and he had a couple seconds to try and memorize all 10 pictures.
Okay.
And then basically when he asked him, you know, later, well, how many pictures did you remember? The guy remembered 4 or 5 of the pictures.
About half.
Right? So then...
Did they hit him on the head?
He did here comes the experiment. So the experiment is he shows him 10 new pictures.
But he slowed down time.
No. But he basically is showing him the 10 pictures as he's being pushed out of an airplane to parachute down to Earth.
Oh, I just got a chill.
And
what a great idea.
And so
I have heard about stuff like this.
And so of course... the guy easily nailed all 10, because the theory is,
it is a well,
your perception of time as you are in danger and afraid for your life, your perception of time,
slows down to save us.
Yeah.
So that every second counts and
wow,
it's humans.
This is blowing my mind.
Humans want to survive, right? We've survived through a lot of things despite our best efforts. And we will have the, that's why too, like in an accident or if there's like, you know, Dave, we've been through 9/11. That's a traumatic event. I can remember vividly, even to the point of what I had.
That is true.
On that
I do remember a lot
in New York,
from that day.
What I was wearing that day in New York City. I remember.
Yeah.
Because of that kind of thing.
Huh. What,
that's fascinating.
That is interesting.
Now,
what kind of pictures was he showing him? Like animals or?
You know, just, it was.
How was he fly? So is he jumped out of the airplane with him?
Another guy. It was attached to another guy, and he had a pair of goggles on where he had the cell phone in the goggles.
Oh, okay.
And so basically, you know, the guy hit the start button and then pushed him out of the plane.
Wild.
Did he know he was getting pushed out of the plane?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was part of the experiment.
Clearly. He's up there. He's strapped up.
Well, it'd be even better if he didn't know, and then they pushed him out.
That's true. Yeah, but you wouldn't remember.
He wouldn't remember anything if he wasn't ready to remember.
That's so cool.
Wow, that's fascinating.
But I just happened to see that this week.
I love that.
Huh.
So how was your week?
Yeah.
Watching TV?
Other than that,
kicking back?
Hanging out?
Yeah, I wish. So, you know, this has been a tough week. So I had the problem with my knee. You know, and it's still an issue. I'm waiting on the MRI. I know I probably need to have surgery.
Ugh.
I'm on crutches. You know, I had to arrange for a close parking spot at work because I work on a campus where normally I'm happy to walk the half a mile from the parking lot to the building and back for exercise.
Yeah.
But when, you know, you can barely stand, you know, that's a bit of a struggle. So I don't know. I sort of got that straightened out. I'm back at work to where I can actually, I'm actually productive at work again.
That's good.
But even like walking down to the cafeteria with crutches.
Oh, so you're now being productive at work. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Ding.
So, but it's getting back to all that as well.
Yeah.
And then, we did have one incident a couple nights ago.
Oh, a ghost.
So now we
oh, why'd you think of that?
Okay. Not a ghost.
I didn't even think of that.
It's horrible month.
That's true.
So we have all these animatronics,
so
probably a dozen scary animatronics up for Halloween.
I know. I was wondering about those in the snow. Do you
guys
stop them in the snow?
When I went over to Andrew's house last week to pick him up because he couldn't drive.
I got to go by.
I pulled into the cul-de-sac there and I thought there was a convention of people standing out drinking coffee. I'm like, oh, Andrew's he's perfectly fine. He's standing here waiting for it. We know it's a bunch of animatronics in his front yard standing around.
And I will say they look a little creepy in the snow. In the snowstorm.
I bet they do.
They look pretty creepy.
That's what I was thinking.
So our house backs up to the High Line Canal.
Mm-hmm.
And so this year, I suggested to Peter, you know, we should put one of the animatronics out by the canal.
Well, that's a good idea. Mm-hmm.
And so we did. We took like this 8-foot tall animatronic. I tied him to the fence behind the property.
Good idea.
And he plugs in and he makes all these sounds and things like that. So you have a slew of people running and jogging up and down the up and down the trail.
Right.
Yeah.
And I hooked up a fog machine and a strobe light.
Wow.
And everything.
That is an extremely, extremely popular running trail. Yeah.
You're a good dad. That would make Peter really happy.
Yeah, it definitely made him happy. Yeah. So now,
does it make the people running by happy?
No, but it makes Peter happy.
Well, and for the most part, the people on the trail,
I bet they love it.
Appreciate it as well.
I wouldn't mind. I'd be kind of excited about it.
So two nights ago,
it's fun.
About 100 feet down from our house on the trail,
yes,
they had emergency vehicles.
Oh.
They had an ambulance. You know, they had
a fire engine.
Oh, Andrew.
And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God,
what have you done?
What if somebody is jogging close to nighttime and they happen to look over,
yeah,
see this clown, think the clown is chasing them.
Oh my goodness.
And the heart's already
have a heart attack.
Yeah.
Have a heart attack or something on the trail. So I'm thinking, okay. And then Peter assures me, well, Dad, we didn't actually plug him in this afternoon. I'm thinking, okay, well, at least that. Well, it was actually probably some kids experimenting with drugs is what the issue is. That just happened to be on the trail there. So fortunately, did not turn out to be a heart attack from somebody looking at our scary animatronics.
Okay, thank goodness for that. Well, all right, very good. Sounds like an interesting time. We're glad to see you're hobbling around a little bit better. Still looking like a grizzled old war veteran right now. However, speaking of war veterans, let's get to
that's
it.
Your segue.
Thank you. Okay. I worked that through in my head as I was saying it. We've got a very special guest. S.C. Gwynn is the author of two acclaimed books on American history, Empire of the Summer Moon, which spent 82 weeks, check this out, on the New York Times bestseller list. That is over a year. Last night I checked. 82 weeks, I think, is longer than a year.
Oh, yeah, yes. Most definitely.
So his book, Empire of the Summer Moon, spent 82 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
That's impressive.
Uh-huh. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award.
Now, that is really impressive. I saw this author's picture.
Yes.
If you picture a Pulitzer Prize winning author, this guy looks like one.
He absolutely does.
He has the look, so I applaud you, sir, for the
look. That's right. He doesn't sound like one, though, interestingly
enough. Oh, really?
Because if I would ever talk to a Pulitzer Prize winner, I would picture them to be kind of pompous and just kind of, well,
yeah,
in my book.
Yeah.
No, this guy was great.
Sort of like Mark.
Mark?
Mark. Omasic. Didn't he get a Pulitzer?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Oh,
we
yeah.
have had a Pulitzer Prize winner.
And he was a nice guy.
So what am I talking about? Mark Omasic, yes.
Did he win a Pulitzer?
He did, for his coverage of Columbine. Speaking of Columbine.
And this guy was there at Columbine,
Gwynn
too.
Gwynn was here to cover that as well.
Oh, they might know each other.
They might. I don't know. There were the droves of media here.
That's a good point. I don't know what I'm thinking.
His other book, Rebel Yell, The Violence, Passion, and Redemption of Stonewall Jackson, was also a finalist for the New York Book Critics Circle. His new book is called Hymns of the Republic, The Story of the Final Year of the American Civil War. This is a very entertaining book, quite fascinating. I really enjoyed this book. I also really enjoyed this conversation. Here is my talk with S.C. Gwynn.
He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on.
I was really disappointed, I have to tell you, when I first started researching the Civil War. I thought, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
I just can't wait for like the Gettysburg reenactment or the Antietam reenactment or the Fredericksburg. So I'm just going to go there and it's going to be great.
Sure.
Because, you know, and then what you learn is that reenactments do not take place on the battlefields. That's a rule. No one wants to have Americans refighting battles on the Antietam or Gettysburg battles. So when you see it, it's done on a farm somewhere nearby. My problem as a historian is terrain is everything to me. Terrain, that's my deal, is terrain.
Okay, yeah.
So I got to do it on a farm. No, I really went, oh, you're kidding me. I said, really? You can't like go to Antietam and be anyway. So that kind of took the, but I've been around a few, but I do love the guys who do it though. They're really great. And, you know,
I picture you like as a coach on the sidelines with like a megaphone, you know, shouting out instructions. No, to the right, to the right.
It would be so cool to mount. They're never going to do it because they don't want the Civil War to be fought again. Literally, that's the reason. But, you know, on one of those great open battlefields where you can still see stuff, you know, clearly, like Antietam, God, would that be cool to mount a full scale?
Oh, man. It'd
be beyond cool. I would be there. I would be in the front ranks, man.
I bet you will. Now, so your book, it is an entertaining and exquisitely detailed account of the final year of the Civil War, wherein, so you have each of the chapters, and each chapter goes into detail, great detail, a different personality or event. And I was just curious, what made you decide to structure the book this way?
So basically what, you know, if you're going to choose, so in my previous book was a biography of Stonewall Jackson. So essentially by choosing that, I've narrowed the aperture of the war. Well, not only the war, but the war, if you're talking about the war, to this man. It's going to be about Jackson. So you can kind of define, you're not just writing about the whole war, you're writing about Stonewall Jackson and the war. In this case, I picked a year, and I picked it very specifically because I realized just how incredibly bitter, how much more bitter the war had become in the last year as opposed to Jackson's year. So I'd pick this, and then so then you've got a year, which is a really interesting aperture, but then you have – it also brings up an immediate narrative problem because you cannot – so well, if I'm writing a biography of Lee or Jackson or Grant,
right,
I could just track it in a linear way, right? Just follow the guy around, right?
Sure.
It's all itself. There's no looping back on the narrative. Stonewall Jackson around. In this case, let's say you have the great Overland campaign, Lee against Grant, you know, in Virginia, Wilderness, Pennsylvania, so forth. Takes place at the same time as Sherman is now in his Atlanta campaign. So you have simultaneous events going on. You have events, you know, the election of 1864 occurs simultaneously with, you know, a military action elsewhere. Anyway, so what you have to do is you have to solve those narrative problems somehow. You can't have them happening simultaneously.
I tried
– the book, roughly speaking, marches in a linear way forward from Grant's arrival in Washington to take control of the armies in March of 1864 to Appomattox, roughly. It goes beyond Appomattox, but you can think of it that way. That's about a year. It basically marches forward so that you can – I mean, I call it the story of the final year of the Civil War, and I mean, I try to tell it like a story as best I can, even though there is some looping back because of the simultaneity of events, but try to keep it going. And, you know, and of course it's a great mystery who won, you know, and because no one knows who won, and what happened to Lincoln, no one knows that. So it's great.
No,
suspense, you know, terrific suspense.
Yeah. Like, it's just like the movie Titanic, you know, right?
Exactly.
I think that movie did all right. So I don't think it matters if we know the ending or not, but it's great the way you can drop into each chapter and though it's not, you know, concurrent or whatever, just to be able to stay in that world and in that place, you know, really lets you get a deeper understanding into it and really live in that little world for that chapter. So I like the way it was structured.
Well, good. Thank you.
So you decide to write a book about the Civil War. Now, there's so much information out there. How do you go about researching a book and like deciding which stories that you want to tell?
It's a bitch, man. Because it's one thing, I mean, it's like you're picking the Civil War, which is, it's the greatest and most interesting piece of American history. And nothing's, to my mind, even a close second. It's the definitive, defining, transcendent event in American history. And so you're picking a great event, which is great and fantastic, full of just these characters that, you know, any writer would die for. And yet, everybody else did it too. So we have, you know, gymnasiums and libraries, you know, stacked full of books about the Civil War.
Right.
So my feeling is, well, twofold. One, you know, each generation kind of takes its own whack at the war, and with good reason, because each generation defines it completely differently.
Absolutely.
If you look at something like Reconstruction, which happened right after the war, the period after the war, entirely starting in the 60s, they completely changed the entire definition of what it was and what it meant, just because a new generation got a hold of it.
Right.
So in my case, you know, we're You know, it's like, it's not like you're going to say, okay, we're in 1950 now. We don't need any more Civil War history. That means that, you know, Ron Chernow and Doris Kearns Goodwin, those people should not have written their books, you know, because it's already been done and we've already done this. So there really is opportunity when you approach it to do something new, to take it. And by new, I don't mean that I found, you know, Grant's secret letters to, I mean, because in the Civil War, that's another thing you're not likely to have access to because it's been scoured very far. You're not likely, every once in a while, you know, somebody finds one of those or a trove of that stuff. But basically, it's angle. It's what you say about it. It's your analysis of what went on. Right. And I think, without seeming too vainglorious or arrogant, I think my book is a fresh take on the war. I take my Grant or Lee chapters. There are a couple that are dedicated to them. If anybody's read those before, please send them to me. I don't think that angle, that take, awesome, that way of looking at the world. My chapter on Clara Barton, one of the great heroes of the war, I don't think you're going to find it anywhere else. And again, I'll pay you a lot of money if you can find it and send it to me. So I think that, I mean, I do think, I don't want to be too arrogant, but I do think I'm presenting a fresh take on this war. The as I said earlier, the narrowing of the aperture to a year, at least to me, made sense, because what I was, I think, really writing about as much as anything else was just how hard and bitter and desperate and vengeful the war had turned. And there's so many reasons for that. It's the anti-civilian warfare against the South by Sheridan and Sherman. You have the rise of the prison camps on both sides, which were just horrendous. You had the advent of 180,000 black soldiers in the Northern Army. You had the destruction of the South, the outright destruction of the South.
Yeah.
You know, economically speaking, and just, so, you know, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to tell that story, and I wanted to communicate that, and that becomes, so anyway, that became the theme. The driving theme was just how it had changed, because the war was really an entirely different thing than it was in the first year of the war, including the reason for the war. That was different too. So everything changed.
I was curious. So when you started out your research for this book, was there something that you found that you, after researching it, you thought a different way about it? Something that surprised you?
I think that, you know, there's always, when I write a book, there's always sort of a discovery of someone that you weren't quite prepared for. I mean, right, not necessarily something new, but a way of thinking about somebody. I think the way the black soldiers, who were 10% of the Union Army, and people don't know that, 60% of them were people who had escaped from slavery just a few months before. I mean, it was just a completely radical thing. Here you have a person who has no legal rights, no rights to marry, no rights to travel, no rights to money, no rights to a bank, no rights to anything. Suddenly, he's got a Union uniform on and a gun in his hands, and he's got a paycheck, not a very big one, but, you know, it's an entirely different world. That changed. But I think what emerged for me, kind of, I was surprised. You know, I knew that, you know, William Tecumseh Sherman, you know, unlike everybody else, he was famous for his march to the sea in Georgia, march through the Carolinas. I guess he emerged as the poster boy. He emerged as this kind of, if I'm going to write about the hard war, the desperate, the really bitter war, then obviously you're writing about Sherman on several, but I didn't quite understand, I guess, to what extent he was a dominant force there, because he was an interesting guy. He was not a very good general. He's a lousy general. Okay. The way you measure generals, like Stonewall Jackson or Lee, he was no good at that. At battle fighting, absolutely transcendently brilliant as the ideologue and theorist and explainer to the world of what was happening in the final year of the war.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So I was like, well, he's a crummy general, but wait a second. Yeah. I think he might be the most brilliant person in all of the war. I mean, period. He really might be. But for reasons, I say in the book that he had, one of his, or part of his genius was to invent a category of genius that had never existed before.
Mm. Interesting. Listen, I was fascinated by your chapter that detailed the Confederate evacuation of Richmond, Virginia. At one point, you're the way you describe it. You got tobacco was burning, the gutters are full of whiskey. It almost sounds like a big party there. But what was the idea behind setting fire to these warehouses of tobacco that ended up igniting the whole city?
Yeah, this was the crazy part.
It was wild.
What Confederates did. So we're at the end of the war here, and we're getting to the end of the war. We're about a week off of that, or more than a week, but we're getting close to about a week off of Appomattox, which would be Lee's surrender. But Richmond has fallen, and the Yankees are coming in, and all the Confederates are fleeing, and many of the townspeople are also fleeing what they think is going to be, they think they're going to be put to the torch and raped and so forth by the incoming Union soldiers. And so they do a couple of things. One, they do something that you would think is predictable and practical from a military standpoint, is they destroy their arsenal, the Richmond arsenal, which goes up when they destroy these things, that the descriptions are just like the world's best fireworks. I mean, the biggest boom. Right. The Richmond arsenal went up. They destroy their ironclads, in the James River with enormous booms. You're going to destroy your military material and hardware and so forth, so that the enemy can't get it. Okay, fine. But burning the tobacco warehouse downtown Richmond, this isn't exactly say. What are we doing here? Are we preventing tobacco from making its way into the pipes of Union soldiers? like somebody getting some free smokes?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's wild. Right? Yeah.
But that's really what sparks. It was not a good night to be lighting fires They lit these tobacco warehouses, and the sparks flew, and it pretty much, any picture, if you've seen those, incredibly, they look like Richmond looks like Hiroshima, literally, Dresden or somewhere. And that is mostly the result of what the Confederates did. This is this enormous fire that burns whole section of the city down that was largely unnecessary. And among other things, they had, were spending time there staving in whiskey barrels again. Well, okay, military value of staving in whiskey barrels. I don't know, but the whiskey was flowing in the streets,
right?
And people were some people were literally lapping it up out of the gutters, but put it in cups, and
Richmond, free booze, man. Who wouldn't? Free booze, sure. Why not? Get in there.
People were drunk, and the slaves who are now, of course, free.
Yeah,
and so they're motivated on many levels. I mean, the master's gone. Well, okay, I'm going to go take the master's, the things that were always denied to me. It's quite a scene. It was kind of a hellish, everything on fire. And then they burn the bridges going out of town, and the ships, the ironclad ships going up. And
yeah, I mean, it's
and
quite
everybody.
A, yeah, it's quite apocalyptic. Yeah, it's apocalyptic.
It's very,
that's
a good word.
Yeah. So in your book, we're talking about Hymns of the Republic. Was there like a subject that you enjoyed writing about the most? Was there like something you were like, well, I could get a whole book out of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, Clara Barton was a great, one of the things that you encounter as a historian of the Civil War is in the war itself, there are just darn few women. There are many ladies out there.
Not a heck of a lot. No.
There are lots of them on the home front and so forth. But the war itself is a guy's deal, and so it becomes a little frustrating. I mean, I do weave Mary Todd Lincoln and Julia Grant and other people in there, but a really good woman like who's up there at the front fighting. Well, I found one, boy,
definitely.
Bart. It's really something. I mean, there is this moment that I'll just describe quickly to you. This
Please.
is, um, I mean, she, this is just before the last year in the war, but it defines who she was. So at some point, she gathers up supplies, and she's delivering these supplies to soldiers who need them, mostly from Massachusetts, where she's from. But at some point, she decides, and she hears that the field hospitals at the front are just woefully undersupplied and understaffed, which is all true. And at some point, she just takes off on her own. She gets some kind of a pass, or sometimes she fudges the pass, and she goes in through the front lines, places Battle of Cedar Mountain and Battle of Second Manassas, and she's going out to the front lines, and she's not only supplying areas, but she's working as a battlefield nurse. There are no other women out there. There is a Army nursing corps, but that they haven't evolved yet enough to get out to the front lines. Anyway, the story I want to tell you is Antietam. So the single bloodiest day in American history is the Battle of Antietam.
Yes.
Right? The single bloodiest part of that battle was the fight in the cornfield in the northern part between Stonewall Jackson and Joe Hooker. I mean, it's literally, in terms of just guys dropping per second, the war didn't see anything like it. And so Clara Barton has fudged her passes, and she's heading out, and she wants to be part of the action. She really wanted to be a soldier, but she couldn't be.
Right.
She's got this carriage with four horses loaded supplies, and she's out, and she ends up right on the edge of the cornfield. I mean, right at virtually in the battle, to the extent that bullets are flying all the way through this field hospital where she is. She arrives at a moment where the surgeons have run out of every conceivable type of supply, every bandage, every ether, whatever they were using. I mean, they've run out of everything. She arrives fresh with fresh supplies. She ends up sitting there working as not only a nurse but a surgeon. She's cutting bullets out of people. She's sitting there in this thing that's literally at the edge of the battlefield. At one point, a piece of a cannonball, she feels a flutter in her shirt or dress, and the man she's holding, you know, dies in her arms. I mean, gets hit by. So it's this, and then when the darkness falls, they say, "Oh, we can't operate anymore in the darkness." She says, "Oh no, I brought lanterns." So she takes the place. But it's this. And it was this great thing. And by the end of this deal, she's being obeyed spontaneously by men who thought women were inferior by this thing. She's giving orders and being obeyed by these hardened veterans. And anyway, this is Clara Barton. So a great discovery. I don't know if I would ever write a biography of her, but I certainly could. And she is that interesting. She's really, and she's not simple, and she's not
right.
She's really something.
No, she is quite remarkable. And the way you write about her really captures that. She might be the answer to this question, but if you could just have a beer with one character or a coffee from the book, who would that be?
Oh gosh.
Only one now.
Oh, maybe I'll give you a Lincoln, of course.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, he doesn't count.
If you removed Lincoln.
Yes, let's remove Lincoln from the book.
Okay. I would have to stack it in order of preference. Lincoln, Grant.
Okay.
Sherman. Butler, Ben Butler, who is this just nutty, interesting, least competent, if not the single least competent Union general. And again, for different reasons, one of the war's most brilliant men. So there's all kinds of contradictions here.
Did you see the Lincoln movie with Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yes.
What did you think of his performance?
I mean, it was fantastic. It was transcendent.
Well, it was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Lincoln is so... You know, I've written about him. I wrote about him in my other book, somewhat, and a lot more in this book. He's just on another plane.
Yeah,
I mean, from everybody, he's on another plane. He's closer to sainthood, put it that way. But he's the greatest, certainly the greatest American who ever lived, and by such a large margin, it's sort of ridiculous. And the more I read about him, the more I study, the more that becomes true. And that's often not the case when you look, say, more closely at Robert E. Lee. And I'm not taking sides north or south, but he's a lot more flawed than he looks, than the Marble Man looks. Lincoln, although flawed, also sort of becomes greater the more you look at him.
Yeah. So conversely to that, which one of the characters from your book would you run screaming the other way if you saw them coming?
I this is going to sound really sexist.
Oh no, it's all right. Please.
Well, okay. Mary Todd Lincoln. Mary Todd Lincoln, because she was such a handful. I mean, and look, you know, she deserves our sympathy. She was a belle of the ball, and she was brilliant, really smart, belle of the ball when she was younger. She had some, I think, mental illness as when she was older. She took the death of a child very hard. And but she was considered by people who knew her, and there's a really interesting story, in fact, about the night Lincoln got assassinated. Or was shot, and he died the next morning. So Julia Grant, Ulysses Grant's wife, had met Mary Todd Lincoln, I think about a month before, and Julia had just been in one of her moods, and she took after Julia, accusing her of measuring the drapes for the White House, and how dare you, and won't you be happy when you get in there and get my husband out, whatever. It was jealousy. Right. So Julia, this is in a carriage ride back in City Point, Virginia, and you know, Julia's horrified. So then after the fall of Richmond and Appomattox and the surrender of Lee's army at Appomattox, they're in Washington, D.C., and Lincoln is supposed to go out with his wife Mary in the carriage to tour the city, which is all in celebration. And Lincoln claims a headache. And so Grant gets the duty to kind of shepherd Mary, you know, out in the carriage through the town. Mm-hmm. Now, Mary gets this idea that the cheers are louder for Grant than for her husband. And she throws a fit and she tries to leave the carriage. I think she does leave the carriage, and Grant somehow talks her off the ledge or whatever, back into the carriage. And so a few nights later, and the Lincolns are going to the theater, to Ford's Theater, and they invite the Grants to sit in their box with him. And Julia says, "No way, I'm not doing that."
Oh, wow.
With Mary. And Ulysses, who's had his own experience, says, "Okay, me neither. Let's think up an excuse why we don't have to go." So they think up the excuse that, well, we're going to go see our children who are north, somewhat north of the city. A couple hours north of the city anyway. Uh-huh. So which is an excuse that they take and they go. So Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, and his wife Ellen are also invited, but Ellen hears about this and tells Julia. She says, "Well, if you're not going to, I'm not going to be alone in the box with her." So Stanton's declined. And the Colfaxes, the Speaker of the House, also declined. I'm not sure why, but it could have been for the same reason. And so you get the Lincolns with this couple in the box that night. The Lincoln was shot. And it's an interesting moment from Grant's point of view, because Grant, for the rest of his life, believed that he could have protected Lincoln had he been there. But it would have been a different scene in the box if you had had the Secretary of War and his wife, Grant, and his wife, the Speaker of the House, and his wife, in addition to the young couple who was there with the Lincolns. But she deserves our sympathy, but she was a tough person to deal with.
Tough cookie, sounds like. Yeah, that's a fascinating story. That is insane. Man.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, that really is. One thing also I wanted to point out about your book, some of the depictions of the like the bullets that you get into and some of the damage that they do to a person's body, some really hellish, insidious kind of stuff here. Was there like a particular image that really struck you as, because this was a horrific and bloody war as you were talking about, and was there something that really just struck you as kind of brought it home to how awful it was?
I think that, yes. So you have these subsonic, these kind of low speed bullets, 58-9 caliber mini balls that would you know, enter and then deform and then sort of tumble. So they would hit you in the elbow, you know, and come out through your throat. I mean, you know, we hit you in the whatever and come out through your kidneys. I mean, they traveled and they did enormous damage along the way. And what they did also is when they hit bone, they splintered it. Mm. And, you know, so if you fall off your motorcycle or something and you break your arm, the doctor can set that because the bone is intact and set it. If your bone is splintered, you can't set the bone. Oh. So amputation is really the only thing you can do. Otherwise you're just going to have an arm hanging there limply, which is why the amputation was just, and the surgeons got really good at it. One every minute or two they could do at some point. But I think to me, one of the worst images of all was at the Battle of the Wilderness, which Lee and Grant fought against each other in Northern Virginia. The battlefield caught fire. So the wilderness was this terrible, like, third growth scrub. Just think dense bushes and brambles and prickers and thorns and brambles and prickers and thorns. Just, just bad. I mean, the worst place to fight. The wilderness was always the worst place to fight.
Sure.
At some point during the battle, a lot of this battlefield, it wouldn't look like a battlefield to you. It just looks like, you know, dense scrub, much of it, caught fire. Mm. And so there were all these men. So, you know, presumably the men who were not wounded could run away from it, but a lot of the wounded couldn't. And a lot of the wounded were just burned in place, burned alive in place. And you could hear their screams as the fire swept. I mean, just screaming and being roasted alive. And one of the more hellish moments, I mean, you asked me for hellish, okay, I'm giving you hellish.
Yeah, give me hellish. Here. Let's go. Let's hell it up.
You know, it was a hellish war. And by the way, fought just at the historical moment before they just figured out what microbes were. They didn't know anything about that. So the fire is sweeping through the forest, you know, and right. roasting all these poor wounded people. But one of the things it also did is the men wore their cartridge belts around their waist, and it would detonate the cartridge belts.
Oh.
And so it just blowing. Oh. I mean, yes, it's like things like that. So you're on fire or something, or the heat.
Oh, man. Detonate.
You're on fire already. You're dying. You're wounded, and now you're being blown apart from the inside by your cartridge.
Oh my God!
You know, it really, it's so grim. And then as I devote a whole chapter in the book to the total medical disaster and your chances of being, finding anywhere comfortable anytime soon were really small.
It's just hard to kind of fathom and really kind of wrap your mind around what was going on. And listen, the book is fantastic. It's called Hymns of the Republic, the story of the final year of the American Civil War. And do you think that there's anything that we can learn from this book that might help us understand what's going on in our divided country right now? It seems like more than ever, we're just as divided now than, you know, we may or may not have been back then.
I it's a question that when I was researching this book, it echoes in every single thing that I read almost. Mm. I mean, it is just that the similarities between the time I'm living in and that time.
Yeah.
Now, not exactly the same. I mean, the issues are not exactly the same, but the depths of the division are the same. And so my father used to have an expression about people who couldn't agree. He would say, you know, they can't even agree that it's Tuesday. Well, I think in a lot of ways America is that way now. If you look at Trump supporters versus non-Trump supporters, for example, I don't think they can agree that it's Tuesday.
Right.
In the Civil War, I mean, there were many, many reasons for the sectional split that brought about secession and the war. But I mean, one of them was just a disagreement on what the war was even about. There was no agreement then, as there isn't now, by the way, about what the war was about. But the lesson that I take from this is maybe broader than that, than even my time and the Civil War. It's like if you go back to the Revolutionary War, it was a nation deeply divided back then. It was divided between loyalty to the crown and loyalty to the revolution. We fought a war over it here, and it was the nation was divided, nowhere near as bitterly as in the Civil War. Then you had the Civil War. The era that I grew up in was the 60s, and the 60s were really deeply, bitterly divided times. It was not only about the Vietnam War. That was a lot of it. It was whether you supported it or opposed it. But, you know, we had cities burning. We had riots in Detroit and Baltimore, Washington, D.C. We had riots at the Chicago Convention. A Democratic political convention, but a very, very divided nation. Mm-hmm. And now we have it again. I guess what I take from this, and I don't want to seem too cynical, I think we live in a nation that is almost by nature divided. Because of this miraculous form of government that we have been able to hold it together. You know, that we have this republic that somehow this democratic republic that somehow gets through. And I would think, so getting back to the Civil War, this was the biggest test. And we'll never face another test like this one. What's going on now pales in comparison, even though our president is predicting. Our president last week predicted a civil war, which I immediately saw and thought, okay, that's interesting. I mean, I can't remember what the context was. It was something like, if you try to remove me, there will be a civil war or something like
that. Something like that.
But there's no way I don't, and I hope I'm right about this, that there's anything ahead of us that could possibly replicate 750,000 deaths and 600,000 wounded. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I just don't think we're going to be looking at that. But and so in that sense, you look back and say this was a giant cataclysm, the Civil War. And we got through it as a country. And we came out on the other end to actually become the dominant country in the world after our Civil War. So, I mean, I guess I take, even though it may sound pessimistic, I am optimistic. But I do think the lesson is accept your nation as a place that is a divided place. People don't agree. People can get violent about it, mm-hmm. And as I say, but I think the Civil War is an example of how we muddle through even under the worst of situations. That would be my guardedly optimistic take, I guess.
I like that. Muddle through. I think sometimes that's muddle the best we can somehow, hope through.
Democracy is messy as hell, man. It's not clean. It's difficult.
And, that's right.
Anyway.
All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk to me. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed the book, Hymns of the Republic. I didn't even get to talk to you about the football book. That book sounds really good. I was reading about that one.
Someday, if you want to talk about it, be happy. It's all, you know, since I wrote it, it's now all over. If you turn on the TV, you're talking, they're looking at all these air raid quarterbacks. It's
yeah, about I know.
Pat Mahomes and Baker Mayfield. And, you know, these are all people out of the air raid system. And, Lincoln Riley at Oklahoma and everything. Anyway, so anytime you want to talk.
All right, cool. So I really liked that chat. You know, just the stories he tells. You know, they're so entertaining.
Fantastic.
And the book itself is entertaining. The anecdotes, they're interesting. The people. These people, you've heard about these people a million times
Mary
before,
Todd, Abraham
but
Lincoln,
the way
Joe
that
Lee.
He paints them in the book, it's they really come to life. This is history told in a readable, extremely accessible way that is also very thought-provoking. Hmm. Highly recommend. This is a fantastic book. This is, again, it's called Hymns of the Republic, the story of the final year of the American Civil War.
Well, you know, with a name and initials like S.C. Gwynn.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're right. You should write sci-fi.
He could be writing science fiction or fantasy. Yeah.
Well, Sam, he introduced himself as Sam.
Good point, Andrew.
But you're right, S.C. Gwynn. Maybe he needs to... but speaking of other genres, he did. Now, I'm really excited. We're going to have him back on the show in December.
Dave was so excited about this.
At the end of the interview, you heard me tell him how upset I was I didn't get to talk to him about the football book. And that football book, I just got my copy of it. I'm very excited. It is called The Perfect Pass. It's American Genius and the Reinvention of Football, all about the air raid offense. We're going to talk some football in December, maybe January, when the NFL playoffs roll around. Really, really excited to read that. It's been described as Moneyball for football fans.
This looks fantastic.
Yeah, it looks. I started reading it and was already amused and entertained. Mm. So that is S.C. Gwynn. There you go. All right, well, let's get to it. It's time for a little young adult shout out. Laura, right. Take it away.
All right, I got El Defo by C.C. Bell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, illustrated by David Lasky. This is a graphic novel. It's for elementary readers. It's about an elementary age girl named C.C. who has to wear a huge hearing aid around her neck, kind of on her chest. You guys have probably seen those where they wear them. They're different nowadays, but back in the day, you had to do
yeah,
that.
I've got a story about that in a second. Go ahead.
Okay. So she was at an all deaf school and she had to switch to a regular school. And all she really wants is what we all really want, most of us anyway, to fit in, find friends, be accepted. But being the only hearing impaired girl is not easy, as you can imagine. So she adopts a superhero attitude towards it and becomes El Defo.
Hmm.
Uh-huh. This is a charming, sweet book. And Sylvia, who was already interested in deaf people, I don't know why, She's always been fascinated by them. She even took sign language.
She did.
Multiple times, has checked the books out of the library for sign language. She became even more interested in people who couldn't hear and read this book multiple times. This is a fantastic book, El Defo by C.C. Bell.
Cool. Very good. Yeah, I have a student in my class now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she is sightless.
Uh-huh.
And she just came. So this girl, not only, so she has a cane, she's completely sightless.
Mm-hmm.
She just came over here from the Marshall Islands. So she's new to this country.
Wow.
We don't have a vision impaired center at our school or anything. She's
it's a
the
regular
only
high
one,
school.
Just a regular high school. But she also has a severe hearing loss.
Wow.
So she wears these two big hearing aids in her ears. And when she first came in, like the first day she's in class, and she's got these big hearing aids. And I'm walking around the room, and I'm chatting. First of all, just what a delightful young lady this girl is. She turned out to be just
a true young lady. Also,
a true young lady. She is an absolute delight to have in the classroom. Just such a great attitude. Always laughing. Always with a smile on her face. She's now shown an interest in being in our play after
That's
school.
Awesome.
So she's joined our play after school. I'm really, really excited about that. But the first day she was in the room, sometimes these kids, now this might surprise you to know this, but sometimes kids do funny things with their cell phones and like to play little pranks with their cell phones.
Yeah, surprising.
So I'm walking around the room and I keep hearing this high-pitched beeping noise.
Oh.
I'm glaring around because I've had kids before. There's an app where you can get. You can make your cell phone make these high-pitched.
Mosquito ringtones.
Beeping noise, whatever it is. And it's going on, and for like 5 minutes, I hear it. It goes it goes off, and I'm glaring around. I'm stalking around. I'm looking
trying
around. I'm like, is that just me?
Laughing?
Is that my tinnitus? No one is acting like they hear anything. I'm like, am I going crazy here? What the hell is going on? So finally, I'm like, could whoever is making that noise, please stop.
Oh.
And then, poor little.
Then you felt like a jerk.
Christelle was like, yeah, Mister, I'm getting some new hearing aids. I think.
It's so awful.
So they emit some noise every once in a while.
Did you ask for the earth to swallow you up immediately?
But I did. Yeah. Oh, I can't even tell you how bad I felt. But she has this. So what she does when she comes in the room, she's got a little microphone that she wears around her neck.
Oh.
And she takes it off her neck and she gives it to me when she walks in because obviously I'm loud enough anyway, but just because this is what she does. She's got, I put the microphone around my neck and that connects to her hearing aid.
That's a good idea.
So, of course, now to me, it's just like another toy.
So Dave, you took a trip into the bathroom with the microphone still on?
Come on, Dave. I almost did because we were on the stage one day and they've got the bathrooms right there.
Oh,
and
my goodness. I never even thought of that.
To say, we play little games also where I go into the hallway and I tell a student what they're going to have to act a certain way. And then I would go out and I'd say into the microphone, I'm turning you off, Christelle. I'm turning you off. I'm holding it right up to
Oh, my goodness.
But that's what I love to do. A little stick like that, like I'll just
that's funny.
Can you hear me, Christelle?
Oh, no.
Can you hear me now? And the kids are looking at me like, what's wrong with you? But she just laughs and she thinks it's hilarious.
That,
it's a lot
that
of fun,
is really
but
funny.
We have a lot of fun with that, but yeah, that's my little El Defo story. All right, well, let's get to it. So, how about a little, since this is our last show before Halloween, a little horror talk. I've got our last chance for a little
Let's hear it, Dave.
Music.
What'd you get?
I picked another song for this week.
Okay,
this is,
I have not heard this.
This is Ashley Serena with Lullaby of Woe.
This is creepy.
So this is all about losing sleep. It's a lullaby of woe, don't you know?
Yeah, no thank you.
Sounds like the theme song to Outlander.
Oh, does it? I haven't seen Outlander. Love the books. I've not seen the show. This sounds creepy to me.
Yeah, it's the lullaby of woe.
All right, well, you ready for my lullaby of woe?
Let's here. Well, before we get to that, now, Andrew, you keep asking,
Don't shake your head because you've been asking for this.
That's true.
You have been asking if there are any murderers or killers or anything like that who've actually written books in prison or...
Well, no, and specific that I was looking for is if there's any authors that it turned out that they had that they were basically serial killers.
Or crime, have killed somebody or done something.
So I'm not really looking for criminals who have written books in prison, but really more... Yeah.
Is that what you looked for, Dave?
Well, I'm just going to read you what I
Tell
got.
Tell us what you got.
All right. So the point is this.
I'm interested in
there
either.
Are no serial killers who've been out there writing. Certainly, they've written nonfiction books about their accounts, but we're not interested in that. We're interested in novels on this particular episode, except for the book that I just promoted.
Yeah.
But 1954, Christchurch, New Zealand. Juliet Hume, 15 years old, had a friend named Pauline, a very close friend. These girls were best friends. Suddenly, Juliet finds out that her parents are splitting up and her mother is going to take her to South Africa. Basically, the other side of the world, and she would never get a chance to see her friend again. Outraged at this, the girls come up with a plan to stop the mother from taking poor Juliet away. And on the afternoon of June 22nd, 1954, they stick half a brick in an old stocking. They lure Juliet's mother to Victoria Park under the pretense of a walk. Down a secluded path, they bashed her to death by hitting her more than 20 times with this weapon, killing her. Now, this case sparked outrage in New Zealand, as you might imagine. Sensational media coverage that speculated the girls were insane, they were diabolical, perhaps they were lesbian lovers, all kinds of speculation about
lesbians
these girls.
Lesbians must have done it.
Right. Now, the girls were convicted of murder and released after serving 5 years in separate institutions.
Just five.
Upon her release, Juliet was able to disappear into a new name and new life in the United Kingdom. Smash cut to 40 years later.
J.K. Rowling.
The successful writer, Anne Perry, was living in the United Kingdom and was working on her 19th novel.
Wow.
When she received word about a movie that was being made. That movie... Heavenly Creatures.
Wow.
And it detailed her childhood. For you see, Anne Perry was Juliet Hume. And her secret was about to be released to the world.
That is crazy.
I mean, and how insane is that? Although it actually seemed to have helped her career, as she's now written over 100 novels that have sold over 20 million copies worldwide, including her critically acclaimed Thomas Pitt and William Monk series, a five-part series set during the First World War, and her annual, get this, her annual Christmas novellas. So there's a little nice Christmas
I see her books
you.
All the time, Dave. I've seen Beautiful Creatures. It's a great movie.
Heavenly Creatures.
Sorry. Uh-huh. Heavenly Creatures. It's a great movie. And it's weird. I forgot that was Anne Perry.
Yeah, that is
Anne
Perry.
Because I see her mystery novels all the time.
They smashed her mother with a brick.
Not her mother. It was her friend's mother.
Over 20 times.
Wow.
Yeah, her friends. Yeah.
Wow.
So there's your first account. Number two.
That's crazy.
Yes. Number two. I give to you Nancy Crampton Brophy, aged 68.
Oh.
Now, Nancy is a romance novelist. Nancy wrote books about relationships that were, quote, wrong, but, quote, never felt so right. And if you take a look at her books... On the cover, you'll find lots of shirtless men on the cover. You know, this is a romance novelist, of course. Many bare-chested men. You can look her up on Goodreads. Now,
what's her name again?
Her name is Nancy Brophy.
Okay.
As in trophy, but with a B.
Got it.
Now, in her book, The Wrong Cop, she wrote about a woman who, quote, spent every day of her marriage fantasizing about killing her husband.
Oh.
In her book, The Wrong Husband, a woman tried to flee an abusive husband by faking her own death. And
She once wrote an essay called How to Murder Your Husband.
Oh, no, Dave.
In which she wrote about how to get away killing your... And I'd like to read from you a quick passage.
Hey, I'm going to show Andrew from this, a picture
of
you
saw the
woman.
Picture. Yeah, I was going to show you this picture. There's a picture of that woman.
Oh my gosh. If you want to send chills down your spine.
Yeah, good luck sleeping after looking at
Brophy.
That. Now, I want to read you from this essay before I give you the kicker. She says, quote, as a romantic suspense writer, I spent a lot of time thinking about murder and consequently about police procedure. In it, she says that if you use a gun, consider that they are loud, messy, require some skill. If it takes 10 shots for the sucker to die, either you have terrible aim or he's on drugs. Well, for Nancy, it only took her 2 shots.
Wow.
Because Nancy Brophy was arrested last year and is now awaiting trial for killing her husband. Her 63-year-old husband's body was found lying on the kitchen in the Oregon Culinary School where he taught. Found by students walking into class, dead.
That's terrible.
Of 2 gunshots.
Wow.
I mean...
That's shocking to me.
A romance novelist.
Hmm.
Wow. So there you go. 2 writers, one who
and
turned
then
into a killer.
She wrote about what she, you know what they say, Dave, write about what you want to know.
Write what you know.
No, no, it's not what you know. It's what you want to know.
Write about what you want to know.
And that's what she wanted to know.
She wanted to kill her husband. I mean, the guy, I guess anybody who's married to a novelist who's writing murder mysteries isn't going to think that they're on the list, but she's writing a lot about wanting to kill her husband.
Wow.
I don't know. After looking at that picture of her, I think there's like anybody would be on the list.
Well, yeah. I think after looking at that picture, her husband got off lucky, is what.
Yeah, that picture is insane.
Because she looks a little crazed.
She looks like she's lost her mind.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
wow. Dave, those were great. I can't stop looking at Nancy.
You need
right
to
now.
Tear yourself away from the picture of Nancy Brophy.
Gotta stop.
And let's open it up. Let's get to it. Time for some
book reviews.
And Laura, let's start with you.
Laura Medicus.
All right, Dave, I have The Devil Crept In by Anya Allborn.
Anya Allborn.
Dave,
very
you recommended
good.
An audiobook by this author.
She's a great horror writer. Absolutely, yes.
And kind of unbeknownst to you, I just finished a book by her. So sorry about that.
I
actually finished it when you told me that you had the audiobook.
Are doing the readers a favor by now. If they didn't listen to Brother, now they'll know we're serious about this woman, Anya Allborn. She knows how to concoct a horror story.
Oh, she definitely does. So her book, your book was called Brother.
Brother, yes.
This book, I think, should have been called Mother.
Oh.
It's straight up horror, and it's horror with mommy issues, which is just like, wow.
Well,
yeah.
Interesting.
But it's called The Devil Crept In. But again,
now
I would like to say it should have been called Mother. So this book is about a 10-year-old boy named Stevie. So Stevie lives with his mom, his older brother, and his abusive stepdad in a small town in Oregon. They live next door to his best friend, Jude, who's also his cousin.
No, speaking of Oregon, is it anywhere near the Oregon Culinary Institute?
I know. I just thought of that. Weird, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Jude's pretty much the only kid and pretty much almost the only human being that's kind to Stevie. Mm. So these two kids are about the same age, with 10-year-olds. They have a secret treehouse in the woods together. They kind of run through town scavenging materials. At first it feels a little like it, you know, with the two boys, and it's a little like, oh, there's that scary house or different things like summertime idyllic childhood,
sure.
I guess.
Uh-huh.
But, Stevie is also suffering from mental illness. He sees things that aren't there, and he has kind of like a Tourette's like problem with his speech. I think I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's echolalia, where he rhymes stuff.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
I've heard of that.
I have.
Yeah. So here's part of the mother horror. His mother knows that her son has these problems, and she never takes him to get help.
Mm.
Never. And she also is married to a man who hits her and hits her children. So that's the other part that's just horror. One day, Jude, his cousin, goes missing. search parties. There's missing boy flyers. There's all this, like, don't go in the woods. There could be someone lurking in the woods. Mm-hmm. There's a timeline because everyone knows in town that you have 48 hours to really find that missing person.
Yeah, chances go way down.
Chances go way down. Right. Because they also had a boy from this town who went missing a few years ago, and he was never found. About the same age. And then there's also something else weird about the town that Stevie is starting to notice as he kind of realizes that something happened to his cousin. No one can have a pet in this town because the pets disappear too. There's also a creepy house that's featured in this book that's isolated. It's on the edge of town. I don't want to give too much away, but there's also a mother in that house who's very disturbing. So this is a story about Stevie and his search to find out what happens or happened to Jude, what's going on with his town. And this is also a horror story about mothers who don't do the right thing by their children.
Do you think this author shows these books to her mom, her own mother?
I don't know. It's a good question. Like, this is mommy issues.
Because the other one is about brother. I mean, there's some serious mommy stuff.
There were mommy
going,
issues in that, too. I wanted to talk to you about
yes,
that.
Yes, there's some serious mommy stuff going on in that.
Because what I said with she doesn't get her son help, like our Stevie, the hero, and she, you know, mm-hmm. allows herself to stay in this abusive relationship. That's nothing compared to this other mother in this book.
Well, the mother and brother. And now I've got the rhyming disease.
Yeah.
The mother and brother, and I think I said this in my recommendation of the book, she runs the family, and she's the one who sends the boys out to kill people. So
wow.
she's the one.
So
she's the brains behind the operation.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing a little psychoanalysis here.
I think so. I think we need to talk to Anya and set her straight and mm-hmm. see what's going on.
Yeah. So this is a horror story. There's some supernatural and paranormal kind of aspects to it, most definitely. So it's not just about mothers who are bad. It pushes the limit, and there's some supernatural stuff. It's creepy as all get out. Mm. It is creepy.
She knows how to write creep.
I felt tremendous sympathy for the main character, this boy Stevie, which just kept me turning the pages and... you know, I just wanted to know what happened. This is perfect for Halloween. This is a horror story by Anya Allborn called The Devil Crept In.
All right. Very good.
Creepy. Very appropriate for Halloween.
Thank you, Andrew.
Does he creep in? Carl Sandberg taught us that fog creeps in on tiny cat feet. Does
this particular
devil creep in on goat,
creeps in with a good-looking man, a decent-looking man.
Mm. Mm-hmm. All right, we'll check that one out. Okay, so my book for this week is by Bentley, and I also did a horror book. It is by Bentley Little, and if you haven't read Bentley Little yet, I would highly recommend you go out there and get one of his books. He's written a ton of books. I think he's written since he wrote his first book, The Mailman, mm-hmm. in 1990. I'm sorry, The Revelation, it was called.
Is it about a mailman?
No, but he did write a book called The Mailman,
okay.
which is one of his more popular ones. Hmm. But he won Best First Novel, a Bram Stoker Award,
oh, wow.
in 1990. And since then, he's written basically about one book a year.
Wow.
So the guy's got a lot of material out there. This book that I particularly, one of my favorite ones of his is called The Association, because this is one I think that a lot of people, Andrew, I'm curious to know if you have any particular insight into this, and I'll get to which association that is. Now, you got to love Bentley Little, because here's a guy who, when he was first coming up as a horror writer, he got invited over to Dean Koontz's house.
I was
going to
say, it sounds like Dean Koontz, because Dean Koontz at one point in his career was cranking him out.
Yeah. So, he actually got invited to Dean Koontz's house. He also got invited over to the house the same night as Richard Layman, who we talked about
on
last
imagine?
Show, was coming over. I mean, can you imagine getting invited? So this guy, a brand new horror writer, got invited for dinner with two horror legends, Dean Koontz and Richard Layman. And he says, I read this interview with him. He said, quote,
I was such a rube that I brought along a stack of books for them both to sign. I figured it might be my only chance.
Oh, that is a rube move.
And thought I'd take advantage of the situation. Now I just look back and cringe with embarrassment when I think about
that's,
it.
That's sweet, though.
It is sweet, but you got to act, like you've been there. Yeah, you know? Yeah. Act like you belong. You show up with a stack. It's like, stack oh, this guy.
Oh, that's really guy. Sweet.
But how can you not love a guy like yeah. that, right? So so this is the association. This is from 2001, but it feels like it could have been written today. This book is about a couple. Now, they moved from the big, noisy city of L.A. to what they imagine is their dream house, tucked away in a remote corner of Utah, where our main character, Barry, can find some peace and quiet to write his horror novels. Now, how great is that? I just love a book where a writer, where the main character is a writer. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's a horror book where the main character is a horror writer.
That.
Yeah. Now, this is one of those books where bad things are happening to good people, no matter their best efforts to fend off these bad things, they keep on happening to that. So that's the kind of like
that's the kind of horror.
That's the kind of horror that we're looking at here. In this case, Barry and Maureen, his wife is named Maureen. Now, all they want to do is live out a nice, quiet life in their nice new house in this nice gated community. But there is an organization that is working against them. Now, there are a number of organizations that I think we can all agree on that are up to no good.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the KKK, obviously, we can all agree is a terrible organization. I don't think that we're casting any aspersions on anyone there. The Weinstein Company, I think we can agree, a terrible organization. The Girl Scouts, of course. Well, I mean, they're
but it's not like the Boy Scouts.
The Girl Scouts are just feed exactly. There are no Andrew and I with Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, just feeding into this obesity epidemic. And of course, the organization that this book focuses on, and that is a homeowners association.
The HOA.
The HOA, and this book features the homeowners association from.
I do not like homeowners associations. Perhaps. Power goes to their heads in those. What do you think, Andrew?
Have you ever lived in a homeowner?
Tangled with them?
He is nodding. His head with displeasure.
We grew up in a condo on Maryland's Eastern Shore, and it was a HOA, and the condo association was they were aggressive. You know, and it was a bunch of old people that wanted to live there, and here we were.
Oh, family.
Three young boys raised by a single dad. And we found ourselves in the crosshairs of that condo association more times than you can shake a stick
wow.
at. And I could tell you.
Or a paintbrush at.
Well, I could tell you, Anthony, we lived in a condo.
Your twin brother.
Yeah, we lived in a condo in as we were older.
Yes.
In just outside of Annapolis. And so basically they were upset with Anthony because he basically had two or three cars.
Anthony
that doesn't
cars.
Sound like Anthony at all. What do you thought? That's weird.
and
the least shocking thing I've ever heard.
So the rules would let him have the cars as long as he had to move the cars every couple of days.
Oh my God.
So
he must have lost a lot of weight shuffling in between those cars.
So he comes on one day and they had put this big obnoxious sticker, like we're talking like a page size sticker. They had put it on like one of his cars and stuff like that. And so of course, so Anthony knew who the person was from the condo association. So he went and took the sticker off his car and plastered it on their front door of that person's, house. But HOA and condo associations definitely, it gets out of hand quick.
It really can.
Well, in this book, it gets out of hand, but it takes a sweet time doing so, interestingly enough. So it starts out, as many good horror books do, kind of innocently, kind of innocuous. Barry and Maureen, they have a yard sale shortly after moving in. One small problem, the association doesn't like yard sales.
No.
And they want to know, did you read the fine print of the Homeowners Association agreement? No yard sales. But don't worry. Don't worry. We'll just let you off for a warning for now. But from there, it just gets worse. The association doesn't like Barry working from home. Maureen is not allowed to grow her own produce in the garden in their backyard. Wow. Oh, and you wanted a pet? Forget about it. And from there, things spiral rapidly out of control for poor old Barry and Maureen, and they are at the literally at the mercy of this association. And you can tell the whole thing, it's kind of, it is a horror book, and it spirals rapidly into horror, but a lot of it is done kind of tongue in cheek. There's some literally laugh out loud moments. There's including a very strange character, a bitter man who's got no arms and no legs. They call him Stumpy.
Oh.
And he pops in from time to time. And by pops in, I mean he kind of rolls around the walking path in the neighborhood wearing a bloody diaper.
Oh, Stumpy.
And covered with like leaves and stuff. And he's got like his old beard. And he yells at people as they walk by him. Very strange. But the book is incredibly entertaining. One thing this book is not.
She's laughing at Stumpy.
I mean, look at it. He's laughing already. It's very, very entertaining.
You need Stumpy out on the Highline Canal.
Never, never a dull, boring moment in this book. The storyline is incredibly interesting. You're wondering how this could possibly get worse for this couple, and boy, it just keeps getting worse. And of course, they are trapped there. They can't get out of their house agreement. Oh, it's so good, so good. And the ending, the final scenes, I'm not going to spoil it to you, but the final scenes just... really a real kick to the old shins. Fascinating, really good stuff. The payoff is just incredible. I love this book. This is The Association by Bentley Little, and that is recommended by
Dave Medicus. So it really is an interesting premise for the book.
Oh, it's just a great premise and yeah. Well executed.
But I can't help thinking about the old jokes. What do you call a man with no arms and no legs floating in the ocean?
Bob. There you go.
What do you call a man with no arms and no legs at the beach?
We know.
Sandy.
Okay. I just know the Matt.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Matt. Yeah. On your front door?
Matt,
yeah. Well, in this case, you call him Stumpy. But, yeah, good point. I'd forgotten all those jokes. Very good. I think Bentley Little would appreciate those. All right, let's get to it, Andrew. What do you got for us this week?
All right.
So the book this week is To Be Taught If Fortunate by Becky Chambers. And so the
whoa! No initials. We got a real first name.
Yeah, we got a real first name.
Also,
I don't know how long it's been since I've had a real first name.
That's a beautiful title.
Well, and it is. And the title is actually an abbreviation.
Really?
And of course, it comes from the golden record on the Voyager probe. Now, of course, you guys both know it. The Voyager probe.
Well, I mean, I was just referencing it earlier today.
For people who don't, you better go ahead.
You better explain that to people who don't know.
You could probably explain that better than we could. Yeah.
Just in case. So in 1977, General Kurt Waldheim, former UN secretary, he basically recorded a quote that went on a golden record. I mean, literally a golden record that was sent on a space probe. That the United States, and I don't know if it was just the U.S., but basically that Earth sent, hurtling out into space.
Oh, all right.
On a journey of discovery.
Was it playing?
Oh, no, it wasn't playing. Oh. But it's there basically.
I don't know.
Oh, silly,
know.
Silly woman.
I didn't know if they were trying to get the sound out.
Oh, but it's
young lady.
Well, they
young
figure,
lady.
They figure that it's actually a golden record, and they figure that any advanced civilization will find a way.
How ironic
to play it
to make something as primitive as a record play, but it literally is a record made of gold that has all kinds of music and other things on it. So one of the
that's
things
so
that,
strange.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
for science
yeah, I know.
Fiction. I mean,
yeah.
And for anybody that's into science fiction.
No. Did that really happen?
Oh, yeah. This is real.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so one of the things is there is a short paragraph where Kurt Waldheim has recorded a message, and I will read part of that message. I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe, seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon. To be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step. And so the title of, of this book is an abbreviation of
our current president would not have written that.
To be taught if we are fortunate.
To be taught if we are fortunate.
You know, and I guess that
okay.
So it implies, and so looking at this book is really a perfect parallel to one the voyage of discovery, mm-hmm. As it hurtles through space. Mm. Now, at present, Voyager 1 is 14 billion miles from Earth.
Wow.
It is the furthest any man-made object.
This one with the golden record on it.
Yep, with the golden record. It is the furthest that any man-made object is from.
Wow.
Is, you know, is, I had it's no furthest idea. Away from planet Earth.
Did they put a did they stick a record player in there?
I don't know if they
I hope they did.
If they put a record player. But,
let's hope they did. But play me. Eat me, play me.
And one you can maybe crank or something.
So there's Voyager 1 and there's Voyager 2, but they do flybys of the planets. They've done flybys of comets and things like that.
And it's still going and they can track it.
It is still going. And then what I read online said is they expect it still to go for another couple of years. Now, this book is a perfect parallel to that because it is in this book, basically Becky Chambers gets into a discussion of science fiction versus science fantasy.
Huh.
And this book is one of the...
Already over my head, though.
Well,
you have to explain that to me. Yeah.
Break that down a little bit.
Well, and so it really comes down to this book is so well researched that the way this book is written...
This is a novel, isn't it?
It's a novella.
Yeah, it's a novel.
But I mean, it's fiction.
It is fiction.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
But it's based on...
But rooted in fact.
It's based on real research.
Right.
And so I'll explain a little bit about the premise of the book. And then I'm going to go in a little bit into detail in terms of Becky Chambers' writing style. And so the book is about a group called OCA who has... It's kind of like a GoFundMe where they've are supporting space exploration. So after 60 years of mankind not doing anything in space, this OCA organization, basically, people contribute pennies, dollars, millions of dollars, and they're able to actually start a series of exploration, of manned exploration.
Okay, and not far-fetched at all.
No.
Far-fetched or fetched.
And this book doesn't talk about like faster-than-light travel or anything. Mm-hmm. They're traveling half the speed of light.
Okay.
And so this journey... is going to take them, you know, more than a decade to get to the first planet to investigate, and so the four people, what's the crew of the Lockheed Six, so Lockheed Six is the name of their spacecraft, and so they're basically put in a type of hibernation which they call torpor, and so what happens is they're going to these four very different planets. One planet has heavy gravity. One planet is a water planet. And so each planet is different. And so they use a technology called somaforming. And what somaforming is in the decade or so that it takes them to reach, you know, from Earth to the first planet, which is Acor, A-E-C-O-R, the somaforming actually, it's kind of like a patch, which is feeding them nutrients, and it's changing their DNA to adapt them to the planet that they're going to explore.
Cool idea.
Oh,
that's a cool
that's
idea.
Fascinating.
And so, and this idea, and you can kind of read in some of the notes after the book that this idea came directly from a lecture that Becky had attended from an MIT PhD candidate who talked about this concept and this idea.
Hmm.
So, you know, this idea of somaforming is... you know, she describes it as it's the practical solution to how mankind can actually go out there and investigate planets like this without needing a ton of resources.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to,
or a giant suit or something.
And that's it. You don't need to change the environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can help to,
we adapt.
And that's it, is we adapt. And so they use somaforming. And so, but the book is written based on real scientific research. And so it's a crew of four. You've got Ariadne, Chikandi, Elena, and Jack. And they're not really couples or anything in the book. They describe themselves as scientists. And their goal is to do this for science. And so before leaving Earth, they realize that, you know, for them, this is going to be an 80 to 100 year round trip.
Wow.
So the moment they leave Earth, they know
they're gone.
That everybody we knew is going to be long gone by the time we come back.
Hmm.
But do they even think they're going to live to come back?
Well, they think they're going to live to come back. So what happens is they actually go in hibernation.
Oh.
And that just kind of slows their metabolism down.
And that's what the torpor is. And it seems like
I see.
For every 20 years that passes, they still age 2 years, approximately like 10.
Okay.
So a year for every 10 years.
10 years. And so they spend approximately 4 years. The plan is to spend 4 years studying each planet. Mm-hmm. You know, so if they spent 16 years studying the planets, and if they spent, let's say, 60 years in transit, you know, so for them, in terms of relative age, they might only age 20 or 30 years, whereas everybody on Earth has aged, you know, 100 years.
They're gone. Yeah.
And so,
like Interstellar, when she comes back and she's older than her mother.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
I know
Matthew
what you mean.
McConaughey is older than, I forget.
He is younger than his daughter.
That's it. There you go. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And that's the thing with space is the distances are so great.
Yeah.
And then there's also Einstein's theory of relativity that the faster you're traveling, the slower time gets.
Which was Interstellar. Yeah.
Which is a proven fact. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that this is true.
Why we're talking all about time on this episode.
Yeah. And so,
put it in a time capsule. That's what they ought to do.
And so, you know, the first chapter of the book talks about I-Corps. And there's a great amount of detail where she talks about the process of arriving, you know, talks about soma forming, talks about torpor, talks about the process of coming out of that, discovering the changes to your body, and then, you know, arriving on the planet. Mm. What's that like? So, you know, there's one scene in which Ariadne is stepping off into the planet I-Corps for the first time. And she's comparing, well, you know, this is what Neil Armstrong said.
Oh.
And so, of course, she says something quite different.
Yeah.
Now, Ariadne, speaking of Interstellar, directed by the same guy who directed Inception, Ariadne was a character in Inception.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Now.
That's interesting.
Now, you know, in terms.
Maybe a little homage there.
And it could be. I wonder if that is an homage to. I mean, then that was a.
Yeah, that
not
could
a
be.
Common name.
Yeah. It is not.
Huh.
And then, so the second planet they visit is Mirabilis. And so Mirabilis, she doesn't describe landing on the planet. Hmm. Instead, you know, she spends that chapter of the book really talking about the process of packing up and making sure that they don't, and decontaminating and departing the planet. Right, focusing on that as well.
Hmm.
Now, this is not a long book; it's less than 200 pages, mm-hmm. but you know it is.
It sounds like a lot, isn't it? Though
it is. It is. You know, and I love this book. I love the detail in the book.
Hmm.
I love the fact that it is science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what Becky talks about is she talks about science fiction versus science fantasy.
Okay,
so yes. Something like Star Wars is really more fantasy.
Oh, that I see. Okay. What do you mean? Yeah,
but. If you know, real,
but it's set in space.
Real hardcore science fiction
mm-hmm.
is really based more on science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, Becky has an ace up her sleeves when it comes to writing this, and this book also contains some correspondence between Becky and her mother Nikki, and her mother Nikki is actually an educator
mm-hmm.
in astrobiology in Southern California.
Oh, wow. Really? Interesting.
Okay.
So there's some correspondence in this book as well.
So that's the big brain on Becky Chambers.
Yeah, questions going back and forth between Becky.
I looked her up on Goodreads, and she's written a few books.
No, and she has. But, you know, I love this book, and I cannot think.
That's great.
I cannot think of a science fiction book I've read
mm-hmm.
that's really more rooted in true science than this book.
Wow. Wow.
But you think, like, this sounds to me like even someone who's not into science fiction could enjoy this book.
And I think that's true. I think that this is a good starting point if you're not a typical science fiction reader.
One mm-hmm. question. This,
yes.
The title of it is poetic. Is the book at all that way, or is it more science fiction-y?
And I would say there's
some moments of that.
There is some artistic qualities to this book.
Okay.
So and what I would say is there is some exploration of, I would say, philosophy in here.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was curious about, because that sounds really interesting to me.
Well, and part of it is, you know, so there's some things like you arrive on this planet. Well, what's it like to arrive on this planet?
Mm-hmm.
There's some soul searching on, you know, we've left our world behind.
Oh.
You know, we are explorers, and that's what we want to do. We want to explore. Hmm. You know, they're on a planet and they're studying life on the planet.
Wow.
And it's looking at, well, you know, what's my experience on this planet? Because these planets are so alien.
Mm-hmm.
But this book immerses you in the science. But there is also a poetry to Becky Chambers' writing as well, that it really does paint these alien landscapes in such detail that you can actually imagine being there. And you can actually feel some of what
it must feel like,
you know, and it's written from the first person, and you can actually feel some of what Ariadne is feeling and some of what she goes through on this voyage of exploration. So I think whether it's Ariadne or whether it's the reader of the book, this is a great voyage of exploration.
Sounds great. It looks like she's been nominated for a Hugo Award winning Wayfarer series. So quite an accomplished writer. Sounds like a great book. I would love to read that.
It sounds fantastic, and kudos to a great title also.
Yep.
And that would tell us the name of that book again. It is
To Be Taught If Fortunate by Becky Chambers.
All right. Recommended by
Also, what a great name. Becky Chambers.
Becky Chambers.
I think I like
BC.
The name Becky.
Yeah, I've always Becky Chambers. I go by my initials, BC.
Would you?
Sure.
I think I'd say it loud and proud, Becky Chambers.
Speaking of being fortunate, you guys, listeners out there, are fortunate enough to hear my audiobook of the week. Because guess what, Andrew? speaking of science fiction, I've got another science fiction book for you. This is my audiobook of the week. Yes, this is Dark Matter by Blake Crouch.
Fun. I like
now, Blake Crouch got a big book right out now. It's called Recursion. I talked about that. This is another great one by him. Now, I'm not going to give away a whole lot about this book because a lot of the fun in this book is in all the different plot twists. You really don't know where the story is going to take you. And when it does take you there, you cannot believe that's where it took you, and you're saying, how in the hell did he do that?
That is very Blake Crouch.
He's so good. Yeah, this book is about the multiverse. Andrew, what do you know about the multiverse or the multiverse? Multiverse. The narrator would always say the multiverse.
Yeah, so the multiverse is referring to the fact that there are multiple universes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So similar to ours, and that, you know, there's hundreds or thousands of them, but things are just slightly different. You know, from one verse to another.
And how that
are
comes
the people
about,
the same in the multiverse?
Well, what he does is he uses sometimes, the analogy of the Schrodinger's cat mind. It's called a mind theory, a mind.
Oh, dear.
What's it called?
Dave's.
Have you heard of the Schrodinger's cat?
Yes,
Andrew?
I have.
Absolutely. Now, do you know about Schrodinger's cat?
Yes. And well, when I was listening to the book and he mentioned the Schrodinger's cat experiment, I knew that I had heard of it, but I couldn't remember exactly what it was. But thankfully, they do explain it. And what it is, in simple terms, Schrodinger stated, and then this is back in, I think, 1939, he stated that if you place a cat
in a box
and something that could kill the cat,
they love the boxes
in that box, and then you seal the box, you would not know if the cat was dead or alive until you opened the box. So that until the box was opened, the cat was, in a sense, both dead and alive.
Didn't he really do this, too?
No. He never did. And in fact, he just used the cat. The cat was just an abstract thing that he grabbed.
Okay.
The cat was
superfluous.
No, he did not actually do that. No.
Okay. Andrew?
Wait, and so I don't know that
Andrew did it with his cat once.
No.
No,
he did not.
No, and there are some amazing things with science, and there's
and this is quantum mechanics.
Yeah, and that's what it's quantum about, mechanics. Yeah. But there are actual scientific tests, and there's scientific tests, I believe, with Schrodinger's theory that have to do with a single particle of light, and basically, as long as it remains unobserved, that particle of light can be in more than one place at the same time, and this is an absolute fact, right? I mean, so when they look at they put like a piece of tissue paper in there, and they will send a single photon of light, and it will show up as an overlapping pattern where the light has actually been in all these places at one time. But the thing is, the moment they observe and they know for a fact that the light has only gone through, let's say, one of the openings out of many, it no longer has this pattern. So the effect the effect of observing.
Observing
the experiment at somehow or another fundamentally changes the results.
Well, that is that forms the base of this book. And so here we have, let me ask you this. What if every time you made a major decision in your life, somewhere in a separate universe, in this multiverse, your life continues on as if you had chosen that other path?
It's a common kind of sci-fi thought.
Yeah. So meaning based on the number of life choices you've made, there could be
variations.
Thousands of Andrew Dowds running around out there living out these other lives.
Dream lives, Andrew.
Dream.
Skiing down.
No podcast. Maybe you're skiing down Mount Everest. Mm-hmm. Who knows what you're doing out there. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine.
Swimming the English Channel.
If you ran into one of these Andrew Dowds. Now, what if you ran into 100 of these Andrew Dowds? Just think about that. Well, this book starts out with the character of Jason. Now, Jason is an ordinary physics professor who's walking home one night when he's suddenly kidnapped and held at gunpoint by a masked stranger who injects him with the drug, and Jason passes out.
Now, this reminds me of that movie, that TV show that we watched.
Which one?
Where they had different lives, and one life was like better than the other life.
Well, I think it's it's a conceit that's been around for a little bit. I don't know. But here...
It's a TV series. Yeah, we've seen it.
Is this a recent TV series?
Are you talking about the Paul Rudd? Because this guy was kind of...
No.
I was kind of...
It's a TV series. It's on Netflix.
The Paul Rudd show. But in this case, when he wakes up, all of a sudden Jason, who's just this regular, living out his normal life as this physics professor, he's surrounded by a crowd of people who are applauding him and telling him, welcome back. We want to hear all about your travels, and treating him as if he was a hero. Well, what he finds out is that this is not my beautiful house. And you may tell where he wakes up, it was not his beautiful house, and it was not his beautiful life. So let's take a quick listen to a clip. This is Dark Matter by Blake Crouch.
Standing happy and slightly drunk in my kitchen, I'm unaware that tonight is the end of all of this. The end of everything I know, everything I love. No one tells you it's all about to change, to be taken away. There's no proximity alert, no indication that you're standing on the precipice. And maybe that's what makes tragedy so tragic. Not just what happens, but how it happens. A sucker punch that comes at you out of nowhere when you're least expecting it. No time to flinch or brace.
So I could not stop listening to this book. It did not get too technical with the science in this book. It was interesting enough to hook me. In fact, the heart of this book, it's almost a romance, because Jason, throughout this whole book, is just trying to get back to his original wife. As he chases her all throughout the multiverse.
It does sound like Living with Yourself with Paul Rudd.
It does, doesn't it?
It's on Netflix right now. Have you seen that, Andrew?
I haven't.
Oh, you got to see that. It's very funny.
Yeah.
But it is a lot like this. There are more than one of Jason, or more than one Paul Rudd, or more than one of all of us running around somewhere in this multiverse.
Now, one of the books I reviewed in the show was Red Shirts.
Oh, I remember that.
By John Scalzi.
Did you see that one of the women who went up in the spaceship recently had a red shirt on?
No, I didn't.
She wore the red shirt. And everyone's like, oh no, she wore the red shirt. And I thought of Andrew.
In that scene... or in that book, one of the characters in that book meets a version of himself in the other verse.
All right, cool.
And let's just say there's some interesting phraseology that happens and speculation about what the two of them spend their time doing.
Well, it's always fun to think about,
I was like, oh.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about what you would say to yourself if you ever ran into yourself.
I'd rather not run into myself. Choking on a sweet tango apple, driving by myself.
Anyway, this book is action-packed. It is surprising at every turn and just so, so damn entertaining. Really, really enjoyed it.
Sounds
give it a
good
listen. That is your
audiobook of the week.
All right, that's the show for this week. We really appreciate you guys listening. If you could do us all a favor and like and subscribe to us on iTunes or Spotify or whatever platform you're listening to us on, that'd be greatly appreciated. Like us on Facebook. It's at The Inside Flap.
Oh, and Dave's been putting up some fun videos.
Yeah, we got some videos up
on Facebook and Instagram
at The Inside Flap. You can access, of course, our website, theinsideflap.com, for all of our past episodes. Really appreciate SC Gwynn for being on the show. Yeah. Can't wait to talk to him again about his football book. Really excited about that. So, thanks again for listening. My name is Dave Medicus. Oh, yes, Andrew, yes. Oh, stop the music, yes.
So I should say, I get a little carried away on my description of the Schrodinger cat, but I think I was actually describing the uncertainty principle. So I will research that for next week to clarify.
Listeners throughout America. Sure,
that is the uncertainty principle, which is, like I said, for me, it is just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
Actually, international listeners are will be sitting at the edge of their seat waiting to hear that report from you. Mm-hmm. So let's make sure what you said, it sounded what I had read. But anyway, that's neither here nor there, nor in a box somewhere waiting to be observed. Thank you for listening. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next week.
We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place. For the first time, T.S. Eliot.
Oh, wow. Have a great weekend. Chew your food carefully.
Yep, and go see Cats.
It's not out yet. By Anya Alborn, The Association by Bentley Little, and To Be Taught If Fortunate by Becky Chambers. Audiobook of the week is Dark Matter by Blake Crouch, narrated by the extraordinary John Lindstrom.
They're just darn few women.